King Radio Network at ParanormalKing.com.
Welcome to the Paranormal News Insider for the week of February 12th, 2019, and episode number 384. And this is your host, Dr. Brian Parsons, and we are live on the Paranormal King Radio Network at ParanormalKing.com. And, yeah, we're holding out. It's February, and I live in Northeast Ohio, and so... Yeah, the weather is not optimal. It's a little windy out here. It's a little windy out at the home. I guess you call it home studios. This is the one of the satellite studios here, too. So bear with us. Hopefully we get through this together. It's the greatest thing about live radio. You never know what can happen. I've been on the radio where the power goes out. Sat here, talked to myself when Skype goes down, didn't know it for a couple of minutes, so you never know what's going to happen. We hope that we'll get the show through to you tonight. And tonight, we're going to be talking about, I've been putting this off for a while, probably about a month, try to ignore it, but it's just like that, that Lego on the ground, or that piece of sock that just seems to go everywhere with you, all over the house. It just won't go away. We're going to talk about that Utah video of Sasquatch. Going to finally address that. We're going to talk about, is that a UFO or blimp? And we're going to mention, I'll mention a little bit more about Project Blue Book. If you haven't heard, there's been an announcement about that television show over the weekend. And if we have some time, I'd like to... kind of get into a little bit, thinking about this for a while, and I really haven't had time since Project Blue Book came out. I want to talk a little bit about UFO investigation methodology. So it's kind of like I'm going to have myself as a guest on the show and talk about my experiences as a UFO investigator and how it's a TV show. You can't really compare and contrast the two, but really what goes on for a UFO investigator, at least myself. I can't speak for other people. So if you have questions about investigating UFOs or how it's done nowadays, feel free to jump in the chat room. We're going to be talking about that probably, I'm going to guess, maybe the bottom of the hour. So about 8:30 Eastern time, probably be hitting that topic of conversation. So you can jump in the chat room, ask me questions. So if you have kind of thoughts, you might want to write them down and get ready for that about UFO investigations. You don't hear too much about that anywhere. You don't, when you go to conferences, conventions, it's all about the ghost investigators showing their orbs, showing their dark pictures of stuff floating through the air, and hearing their EVP that you can't even hear what's going on anyway. You might go to cryptid people. They generally show some stuff, but they really get into their subject matter. And UFO stuff is generally about old cases. But for me, I like to talk about how to investigate this stuff. And I get plenty of people that get really excited about that because usually don't get to see or hear about that. So I'll be talking about that here in a little while. We're also going to be talking about death experiences. Hopefully we don't have one of those on the show tonight. And we'll also talk about dragons. I know it's not paranormal, but it's really cool. And you're going to like that story coming up tonight here on the Paranormal News Insider. And as always, I'm going to mention it. I did work a little bit. Yes, dragons. Darby dragons. I did spend a little bit of time updating the events listing on the website being paranewsinsider.com. So that's your home for all things paranormal events. I've done the best I can so far with a listing of events. It's something I'm very proud of doing. I started doing it a few years ago, and Just did it out of, I don't want to say sheer boredom, but it was just something that I thought, hey, this would be kind of neat. And now I get most of my emails are requests for updating this information or adding stuff or, hey, can you mention our event? And yes, I will. If you email me, I'll talk about your event. I'll mention it. And I've only had a few guests on this show over the course of the last 10 plus years, and they've all been for these types of things. So if you know of any paranormal conference or convention that's not listed on the paranewsinsider.com website, let me know. You can find, there's a link there on the website, paranewsinsider.com. You can click on the about/contact link there and just shoot me an email, or you can email me at insider@paranewsinsider.com. I don't know. Do people still email? I don't know. You can also find me on Facebook at Paranews Insider, I should say, and Twitter at Paranews Insider as well. Don't bother with Google Plus. And it's going to be gone pretty soon anyway. I really don't even pay any attention to that anymore. I need to get on Instagram. That's where the cool kids are, I guess, nowadays. But anyway, yes, conferences, conventions. I've updated this. I have currently 29 ghost events, 16 UFO events. I know there's more. And I just updated, I added a whole bunch of cryptid events. I have 23 cryptid events, including coming up this weekend, the third annual Bigfoot Conference in Hastings, Nebraska. That's getting plenty of press, local press. So they're really excited about that. It's going to be a good time out there. I just hope the weather is cooperative out there in Nebraska. And guys, have fun. Enjoy it. Be safe. But a whole slew of events here all over the place. And I do North America only, unfortunately. I know I have listeners from Australia. I have listeners from the United Kingdom, Russia. I don't know too much Russian. Das Vidanya, that's all. That's it. Moscow Mule. I don't know what else to say. That's pretty much the extent of my Russian right there. Vodka. That's it. That's as far as I go. But I appreciate, no matter where you're from, that you're listening to the show. But primarily, that's all I can handle is updating North American events only. I can't handle anything else. Occasionally, I'll squeeze in a Canadian one because I've attended a couple of those over the years. So, sometimes I'll do that, but that's still technically North America. I don't do any, haven't done really any Mexican events, but that's technically North America as well. But I haven't, primarily United States, but I just say North America just to be nice to my northerly neighbors up there in Canada, because they're nice. They're all nice people, as you know. But looking at this here, I don't have anything until the end of February, February 23rd and 24th, for Ghost Events, the Rochester Winter Parafest 2019, and Geneseo, I don't know how it's pronounced. It's in New York. You'll find it. You probably know where it's at. Then it jumps into March, April. UFO events, same deal, not until March. The UFO Paranormal Summit in Ocean Shores, Washington, out there on the West Coast. So check it out. I'm very proud of this list. I've worked pretty hard on this. I spend probably more time doing this than anything else on this website, as you could probably tell. But it's a lot of fun, and I enjoy giving back. I do attend some of these events, not very many, but I do attend some of these. And some of these I sneak in here because when I do a library event, I'll sneak that in under the heading where it belongs. So if a event is primarily ghost, I'll list it under ghost, although they may have other speakers that do UFOs or cryptozoology. But if it's mostly ghost, I'm going to stick it under the ghost conference heading. And the same if it's mostly UFO, which they pretty much, UFO stuff is pretty much just UFO stuff. They may have a cryptid person or two. Cryptozoology is pretty much the same. It's just primarily going to be Bigfoot. Bigfoot, and maybe a little Bigfoot for good measure, and maybe a big cat. I do big cat stuff. But anyway, right now I don't see my name on here too many places. I'll be at the Haunted Heights Paranormal Convention, May 3rd and the 4th in Houghton Lake Heights, Michigan. That's going to be a fun one. I couldn't go last year. I was invited to, but couldn't make it. Then I have the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure, which I talked about last week and probably the week before and the week before that, even though I was off. Anyway, May 31st through June 2nd in Farmington, Pennsylvania. That is going to be a big event. Big event. It's the third time that event has gone on, but it's going to be it's going to be huge. A lot of people going to be there. There's already been 300 tickets sold for that event, and there's less than 200 remaining. So you'll want to get those quickly and get some lodging too. You got to have somewhere to stay. Not a whole lot of places out there to stay. I mean, I'm going to be, going to be in a tent because it's intense. I ruined that joke. But yes, the Appalachian Investigators Mysterious Sightings Ames, or in other words, the guys from the Mountain Monsters television show. Let's see. Bill Brock, host of the television show Monsters Underground. Ken Gerhard, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, Cliff Berrickman of Finding Bigfoot. And just announced last week, Stacy Brown Jr. will also be there. Let's see. Well, I'm one of the 12 speakers. A lot of great people going to be there. Other speakers, trying to think off the top of my head. Okay, here it is. Ron Murphy, Steve Coles, Dave Dragason, Rick Fisher, Stan Gordon, Jay Bachochin, along with the son, Blake. So it's not 12 speakers. It's 12 and a half speakers, I forgot, because of Jay's son, Blake, speaking. So I guess he's a half a person. I don't think that's appropriate, Jay, but we'll go with it. Paul G. Johnson, Dave Spinks, David Weatherly, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and the 2017 Cryptozoologist of the Year, Seth Breedlove. Yes, we'll be there. And that's just special guests and speakers. There's also going to be workshops there as well, teaching you how to do different things, which I think is awesome. It's a very unique event. Others have tried to replicate this, but this is a one-of-a-kind event. Well, it's the third time this event has been on, but it gets better every time. And first time we did this, I thought it was awesome. I was freezing. It was very, very cold and very, very wet. But I had a very, very good time. And that was with very few big name people coming there. And then the following year, we did it again. Eric Altman did it again. He pulled off a fantastic event. It was even better than the first time, I thought. And then he took the year off last year. And now this, oh my gosh, this event is over the top. It's going to be a fantastic time. And yeah, I'm going to keep talking about it. I'm confused as to what Dita was confused about in the chat room. I don't know what I said. I don't know. I screwed up. I don't know what happened. She's easily confused. Squirrels and things. I don't know. You know how some people are. Anyway, let's get into the news tonight. We're going to talk cryptid news. And, well, again, I didn't cover this. I don't know why. I just kind of sidestepped this. It was just another video to me. And it's not as bad as the UFO videos. I'll say that much. But this one here won't go away. And this is about the Utah video of a purported Bigfoot. This happened back in January. So a group of men filmed what they claimed was a Sasquatch standing in the foothills in northeast Provo, Utah. The video was actually shot on January 2nd and then uploaded to YouTube on January 6th, but did not provide much clarity other than a dark brown blob on a rock. And that automatically makes it a Bigfoot. If you can't tell what it is, and it's brown, and it looks like it's got hair, and it's in the woods, or it's in your backyard, it's got to be a Bigfoot. Can't be anything else. Definitely a Bigfoot. But the person filming it claims the object is definitely a Sasquatch due to its size alone. It's giant. Look how big it is, he says over and over again. They may actually made no effort to get any closer or to investigate further, and they immediately sold this footage to anyone and everyone. They let everyone have whatever they want to put it everywhere, which always kind of makes me wonder why, you know, if I don't know. The Rocky Mountain Sasquatch Organization stated that they went into the area 2 days after they saw the video, but did not find anything conclusive. So was this a bear, a person, a Sasquatch? Well, we'll probably never know. And it's anyone's guess. And people are arguing about it. They're disseminating the video. They're zooming in and pixelating everything and claiming they see an arm or a leg or extra appendage or a baby. I don't know. People see what they want to see, I guess. It's pretty much anyone's guess. And despite the headlines, there isn't any evidence that this was a Sasquatch or Bigfoot, other than what you see there and what they purportedly saw. But there was nothing else gathered. No footprints, no hair, no sounds, no nothing else. The story's got a lot of traction, though, and I just kept seeing it every day, every week, and, you know, it's just not letting up. It's still out there. It's still being covered by a lot of people, and let's see, the New York Post actually just had a thing on it. It's weird because, again, this is the middle of February already, and this has been out for over a month, and it's still being reported as well, so it's weird. And Utah itself has had a recently fairly rich Bigfoot sighting history, but obviously nothing conclusive other than these types of blob squatch videos. A couple stories have come out about Utah lately, man, the last couple of years. I mean, yeah, if it's in the news, it's got to be real, right? Everything is real news. There's no such thing as fake news. Yikes. I don't know. It's a video, and again, it's your interpretation because there's really nothing there that you can definitively say is one thing or another. You can't tell that it's a person. You can't tell that it's not a person. You can't tell that it's a robot. You can't tell that it's not CGI. And the camera was a pretty decent camera. They had it zoomed in very, very well. But I don't know how they would know exactly how big this thing was, because he said, look how far back it is on this rock. But they never went, I mean, 101, first of all, you send somebody up there, you go up there and you film, and you try to find some sort of evidence. Number two, you would place somebody where you think they were standing, and then you go back down and film from that angle to really see how big that thing really was. Maybe it wasn't as big as you think it was. Maybe it was short. Maybe it was bigger than a person. Maybe it was a Sasquatch-sized creature. Then you can communicate via cell phone and have them move around or whatever you have to do. I mean, come on. Finding Bigfoot does it. You should be able to problem solve that much. Anyway. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay, I've got the link here. And, again, it's another perk of being live in the chat room. You get up to the minute fresh links thrown at you in the chat room, so you can read about these stories. And don't worry if you're not in the chat room. I get it. You got things to do, or you're listening to me on Wednesday morning or Wednesday night. Maybe you're driving to work on Wednesday morning listening to the show. I appreciate you. And watch out. You almost hit that tire rolling down the street there, down the freeway. But you're okay. You're good. Keep driving. Yep. But I know you can't always make it, and some people will listen to the show after it's been posted on their podcast of choice. I get that. But never fear. Never fear. Not that you had fear anyway, but I will be posting these links afterward on the aforementioned social media networks, Facebook and Twitter. So sprinkle those throughout the week so you're not inundated with 10 emails or 10 notifications or 10 links all at the same time. I spread them out through the week to make it simple for you. So you have to wait. And I pretty much sprinkle them in the same order in which I talk about them, unless something is big. I got to move them around. So anyway, we're going to jump into UFO news. And, you know, I mentioned Bigfoot videos. Well, UFO videos, they certainly caught up to the vast number of ghost videos that proliferated the internet back in the mid to late 1990s. It was pretty much all you saw. And then UFO videos kind of started to take foot. And then, Bigfoot videos have been sprinkled in here and there. They're not as frequent, I don't think. In my opinion, I think UFO videos have seemingly taken over the paranormal as the number one form of proof of something existing through these videos, even though there's really no proof of them existing at all yet. Back in the early days of UFOs, photographs and videos, one might blame Venus or maybe even swamp gas. That was the big explanation a long time ago. Well, today it seems like the leading causes are drones, airplanes, and maybe the Goodyear blimp. A viral video of a UFO over Tijuana sparked fear and interest with over 700,000 views of a video of an incident over Tijuana. Well, it didn't take too long to figure out that the Goodyear blimp was the object, although many view this as an obvious find. And some think it was a cover-up or misinterpretation. You know, maybe a UFO just made itself look like the Goodyear blimp. Right. Makes perfect sense. The folks covering the Goodyear blimp on Twitter have always been quick to address these videos when they pop up, and even then are always letting everyone know where they're at. And they actually enjoy it when people take pictures of the craft when it flies over. It's an art form. A response to a tweet by UFO of Interest, which exposed he's always exposing videos as an attempt at fraud, is this Twitter response or this tweet. What is that? So you tweet, but is your response a tweet? Should be a quote or I don't know what. Anyway, it reads, quote, "It's like the old saying goes, if it looks like the Goodyear blimp and flies like the Goodyear blimp and it's hovering over an event the Goodyear blimp is covering, call it a UFO anyway and get those clicks," unquote. It's not so much about money sometimes. A lot of times it's just about 15 minutes of fame. People want attention and they'll get it any way they can. Whether it's saying something really rude or mean on the internet, or it's posting a video on Facebook or Twitter or Facebook or YouTube and selling it to the highest bidder, which may only be $10 or something. I don't know. I'm sure these people don't make a whole lot of money doing it, but that's not the point. The point is people are talking about my video and I'm famous and I have a whole bunch of people that come on my site and friend of me or whatever. People like that attention. You know, money is the additional thing here, but I think really it's about 15 minutes of fame. So in the chat room, I've just posted the kind of a screen cap of that tweet exactly. You see ufoofinterest.org, which they do a fantastic job breaking down UFO videos. It's a full-time job. It really is. If I just focus just on UFO videos, it would be a full-time job. It really would be. I don't have the time for that, though. So thank goodness he does, and he does a good job. But I love the Goodyear blimp. Well, I shouldn't say the Goodyear blimp, how it reacts to it, because the blimp is not really a living, breathing creature. The people behind the Goodyear blimp, when they respond to this stuff, and this is very, very typical of their responses. Call it a UFO anyway and get those clicks. It's exactly how they kind of put things in perspective. Gotta love it. And they're used to it. They get a lot of that. The blimp is frequently looked at as a UFO a lot. I've talked about stories, I think it was late last year, a guy down in North Carolina did the same thing. So an article appeared on the International Business Times India news website yesterday with the headline, quote, "Cigar-shaped UFO in California pulls alien buffs to frenzy. Skeptics call it a blimp." In the article, they reference a February 8th sighting by a California resident, which was then reported to MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. Again, a quick search reveals that the Goodyear blimp was in the area at the time of the sighting. And so it's an easy explanation. It was there. It's the exact same shape, and it actually, the thing in your picture, you can, if you look at it at the right moment, you can see that it says Goodyear on the side. I mean, you can tell it's pretty much the same markings. It's just tiring to hear the same thing over and over. But, you know, for me, I'm very fortunate because I grew up in Northeast Ohio, and Akron, Ohio is the home of the Goodyear blimp, and I frequently saw this at a municipal airport down the street from where I lived. I've seen it. I've been very close to it. The old school ones, the gray ones, they were gray with the black writing on it. And the new ones, too. And I go kayaking at the, there's a little lake right there where they keep the blimp in a hangar, and you can see it. It's like right there. So it's pretty cool to see it quite frequently. And some people don't really get to see it much at all or have never seen it. And I'll be honest, when you first see it for the first time, and I've seen it in weird times of the year when I wasn't expecting it. So when you see it, you kind of wonder, wow, what is that? But it doesn't usually take me too long to figure out what I'm looking at. But yeah, it can be a scary sight if you're not sure what it is. But if you're close enough to see it, you're generally close enough to figure out what it is, especially if you see it, its profile, it moves sideways. You could tell it's a blimp. And I've seen other blimps, not just the Goodyear blimp. I've seen other ones. But yeah, it doesn't usually take too long to figure out what it is. So the weird thing about this article, it's kind of like, kind of turned off by the way it was, the headline was, "Oh, skeptics call it a blimp." So it kind of seems like it's pro UFO, that this story is definitely about an unidentified flying object. But then the article finishes with it admitting that the sighting is more than likely the blimp. And it also gives an example of a UFO sighting in Mississippi that turned out to be a blimp as well. And so I thought that was kind of weird that it's just clickbait, I guess, clickbait. And if you're wondering, and we'll find out the following week, if I'm talking about UFOs over Florida next week, well, you're going to know, because the Goodyear blimp will be in the Miami area this coming weekend covering the Daytona 500 NASCAR race. So if you're into that stuff, you're into going around in a circle all day long, yeah, the blimp will be there. Down in Miami, in the surrounding area. I think it flies in either Thursday or Friday. They'll kind of have it flying around there. So it'll be there all weekend, probably Monday as well. So somebody somewhere is going to see this from a distance, maybe Hollywood Beach or something, and they're going to see this thing, not know what it is, and they're going to post a video of it being a UFO. It happens all the time. Not a big deal. And I follow the Goodyear blimp on Twitter. I follow the website. I know where it's going to be, and I kind of anticipate it. So I'm not shocked when I hear a certain area talking about it, that they saw a UFO. So anyway, let me throw that link. Well, let me gently place it in the chat room for you guys, and you can look at that. And we're going to stick with UFOs here for another couple minutes. We're going to talk about Project Blue Book. So if you've not heard about the big announcement for Project Blue Book, well, don't worry, I've got it here for you after these commercials. Just kidding, we don't have commercials, not yet anyway. I might have to make some money sooner or later, but anyway, I heard some rumors about this over the weekend. Somebody made reference to it, And I just kind of dismissed it. But it's true. I've finally seen it. And it was weird because somebody said something on Friday. I was like, I don't know. We'll wait till Monday. And then it was officially announced on Sunday, I think. Pretty sure it was Sunday. The Robert Zemeckis-produced UFO drama Project Blue Book, produced by A&E Studios, that appears on the History Channel, has been renewed for a second season. So what does that mean? Well, the first season is officially halfway over. The first five episodes released, and the next five being released up until episode 10, which is March, I believe that's March 12th. Yes, March 12th is episode 10. So that's the end of the first season. It's a 12-episode run, and then they'll have 10 more next year. So the debut episode, The Fuller Dogfight, first aired on January 8th, and it had 2.27 million U.S. viewers, with a total of 3.88 million viewers overall. The U.S. viewership dropped to 1.88 million viewers with the second episode, but rebounded to 1.95 million with the third, dipped to 1.71, and finally 1.39 million with the latest episode, Foo Fighters. Not the band. Not the band. Not the band. Meanwhile, the total views went to 3.7 million in the second episode to 3.79 million in the third. So far, the fourth and fifth episodes have not had the total viewers numbers released from what I've seen over the weekend. But A&E seems very confident that this show will continue to bring in the viewers for another full season, despite only half of the first year's episodes being released. So they're pretty confident that this is going to finish strong. And, you know, looking at the first three, I mean, that's a good way to go. And I'm sure they have inside information as to what the fourth and fifth is leaning toward as far as total viewership, which is really all you're looking for. And the more episodes you do, you can sell it into various ways to continue to make money off of it. Syndication, DVD releases, box sets, and all sorts of things. And they really went over the top with this. I saw a press kit that they put together for Project Blue Book. It was over the top. They did a, you got like a leather bag and all this stuff. Man, I need to get my press credentials. You got DVDs for the first few episodes. It was very impressive. You know, they spent a lot of money and time into putting this together and this show, and they've done a good job with it. And I'm still kind of not happy with some of the unrealistic stuff that's occurred with it and how they've twisted some of the reality with it. It's just kind of away from the truth, and they've sprinkled it stuff together. The truth and fiction is because really meshed together, and they kind of said it early on that they want the viewers to watch it, and they want them to make their own decisions about whether they believe these stories or not, because they're just essentially they're retelling stories that happened in different periods. But they're skipping over a lot of facts, skipping over a lot of information. So to me, it's kind of confusing. A little bit. I don't know. It's still a decent show. And again, you have to look at it as it's entertainment. It's not, yes, it does flash in the beginning that it says based on real events, but based on real events doesn't mean that it's completely accurate. I don't know. Yeah, we'll continue to watch it. I'll watch it. And I'll see what happens here. But anyway, hope you enjoyed that show. I don't know how much you anyone out there has watched it. I know a lot of people have stopped watching it after a few episodes, but I think it's very, very entertaining. And since the show's come out, I've had a few people ask me about UFOs and UFO some UFO information about how to investigate them. And, you know, I wanted to kind of talk about it a little bit on the show, but the show's been pretty packed when I have them on. So I really haven't gotten too much of a chance to talk about it too much. I just remembered. Yes, June 24th. I know this is totally, I'm like a cat tonight. I'm all over the place. June 24th, I'll be at the Pickaway County Public Library in Circleville, Ohio, and I will be talking about UFOs. So UFOs continues maybe to be a bigger thing, and maybe I lucked out and got in there at the right time, because if this Project Blue Book show continues to be popular, then who knows? It could peak out, and people will really be interested in that as well. And, you know, I started out as a ghost investigator over 20 years ago and got really hooked into ghost investigations and really wasn't too involved in anything else, but slowly but surely got involved in other aspects. I guess you could call it paranormal stuff. So other aspects of the paranormal. And I don't know which one I really jumped into first, but I did start to notice that there are some correlations with UFO sightings and UFO stories that were with ghosts. ESP, psychokinesis, different things that seem to kind of tie the two together. And I thought, well why are these two things related here? And then when I got into cryptozoology, I noticed the same thing, that there's a little bit of common things that kind of tied the two things together, or the three things together. There's just some commonalities there. Question in chat, any exorcisms? Not any that I've performed or any that were performed on me, at least that I'm aware of. When I was younger, I did have a couple blackouts. I don't remember what happened. It was after a night of drinking. But no, I don't really do that stuff. I do have a good friend, Dave Considine, who would swoop in and take care of those for me if I did have a situation like that. So, I'm not really. It's not really my thing. I'm not really not trained to do that. Nor do I really support that, because I think a lot of people who are claimed to be possessed, or people who think another person is possessed, may actually be suffering from a mental disorder, a mental breakdown. And mental disorder is nothing derogatory or negative. It happens to everybody. Well, I shouldn't say everybody, but it happens to a lot of people. It may happen to everybody in a variety of percentages. We all have breakdowns. We all have stress that gets to us, and you know, that could be considered a mental disorder to some extent. But some people, you know, they get a little sideways sometimes, and you know, other people take it as, oh, something has invaded you. I could go down that road. I do think that people do become, I don't want to use the word possessed, but I think hauntings, residual energy, or maybe even negative energy or something that's happening in the house that's causing them to see or perceive things, could be CO2 poisoning or just bad air, or it's what else has been known. Mold has been known to cause hallucinations, but also emotional changes. And I think sometimes those emotional changes, emotional negativity, can lead to a self-perception of being possessed. Because we just your attitude changes, everything changes, and yeah, and we'll leave that there. So went from UFOs to possessions. Wow. Anyway, I got involved in UFOs probably around the year 2000. Then I got into MUFON. I read their MUFON Field Investigator's Manual, which I highly recommend, but it's very expensive. It's going to cost you over $100. So I have, not that I'm competing with it, because it's a completely different book, completely different, I shouldn't say not quite the exact same thing, but kind of a different approach to the thing. My book, Handbook for the Amateur UFO Investigator, which is some of the stuff I want to talk about quickly in the next few minutes before we get to our last couple of stories. I didn't initially want to write a book on UFO investigation because of my respect for the way that MUFON put their book together. But I thought I could do what they did in my own way, not to copy what they did, but kind of look at it from a balanced point of view instead of just a let's investigate a UFO point of view. And I like the way I did it. Kind of a balanced look. I talk about the history of UFO sightings through the commonly thought storylines. And then I kind of put some of the information that's been gathered about those stories. And then I let you, the reader, decide. I'm not going to tell you what to think. I want you to figure it out on your own, because that's what an investigator does. That's what a researcher does. You have to figure these things out. You have to weigh the evidence, weigh the information, and make your decision. And that's what I'm trying to train you to do in that book. So that's two really good resources if you want to get into UFO research and investigations. And I got to say, I really like how Project Blue Book goes about trying to investigate, I guess you could call it debunking, a lot of these stories. And I have to say, one of my favorites so far was the episode on the Flatwoods Monster. I called it. I talked about the owl. Watch out for the owl, because I knew that was a prevailing hypothesis about how, you know, what people actually saw, and they just misinterpreted as this giant monster. On the show, there was a little bit of panic for the witnesses, who seemed to be potentially at the wrong end of a mob, until Dr. Heine quickly solved the case with the help of an owl. So he saw the owl in the tree, and he thought, hey, you know, this looks like the shape of the owl. Maybe it was an owl. And he took the owl to the town square there, and they're ready to stab this family with pitchforks, I guess. I don't know what was going on, but they were really upset at these people. And Dr. Hynek explained, oh, they just saw an owl. And everyone just clapped and walked away, and the crowd dispersed. It's kind of silly. And that's not actually how it happened. The owl hypothesis actually came in about the year 2000, when skeptic Joe Nickel proposed it, along with the information about a multi-state report of a meteor sighting on the night of September 12th, 1952. So it wasn't J. Allen Hynek that quickly came up with that. But either way, it's still an interesting way of how they looked at it, and brought a little bit of logical thought to it. I mean, geez, got this giant creature in the woods, and these kids and this family just see this giant creature staring at them, which they showed. You know, they show that in the beginning of the episode. So you see the scene through the eyes of the witnesses, and then you kind of see it through the eye of the scientists or the skeptics, which is kind of funny. But it's neat that they kind of teach you how to look at that. But I think it's almost like people just roll their eyes. Oh, it's swamp gas. Ah, it's just an owl. That's just this. Yeah, they're just sweeping it under the carpet. But UFO sightings, I would have to say, of, you know, people always ask me when I go on shows, and people ask, well, what's your favorite? Do you like investigating ghosts? Do you like to investigate UFOs? Or do you like investigating cryptids? Which is your favorite? And I always kind of give a wishy-washy answer on, depends on the context, depends on the case, depends on, you know, what I'm doing. You know, or what aspect of the investigation are you talking about? Ghosts are fun for a lot of different things, and cryptids are neat for other things, and UFOs are interesting as well. And I think UFOs, I would have to say, are the easiest to investigate. And people are always like, whoa, what do you mean the easiest to investigate? Because they give you more, there's more ways to disseminate what's seen in the sky than there is what's actually seen in your own backyard, and certainly more than ghosts. And I can explain that a little bit more. But you know, when you get a sighting, when you get a UFO case, you know, what kind of a case is it? Is it a sighting? And if it's a sighting, was it a light in the sky? Was it they see a physical object? You know, sometimes you do bump into the abduction people, contactees, I've never had a crash case before. I would love to have a UFO crash case. That would be awesome. Mostly, you're just going to get videos and photographs sent to you. I saw a UFO. Here it is. It seems like that's just changed in the last 10, 15 years. But before that, people were seeing stuff all over the place, in the sky, everywhere. Now, one of the first questions that I ask is, when can we meet? I mean, it's great to exchange emails, but my gosh, it's horrible turnaround time. You know, you send an email, you might wait a week for a response. You might as well just send a passenger pigeon, even though they're extinct. Or snail mail, for that matter. Phone is great, but it's distracting. And there's no face-to-face contact. A person can have notes in front of them and are reading off of things. So you're better off getting face-to-face as quickly as possible. Find out where it happened. Is it somewhere that we can have access to? Did you see it while you were driving? You know, maybe we can safely go to this highway. Or maybe you were on vacation. Maybe you were on a cruise somewhere in the middle of the ocean and you saw this. Or maybe you're in an airplane and you saw something. That's not really easy to go and replicate that. I mean, you could do some tests with stuff like that. But, you know, you hope that they saw it close to home, maybe in their backyard or down the street, so you can go to that location. And the other thing, too, to consider is, you know, I mentioned a crash, which I've never had. But if there was physical contact with the environment, that changes everything. The entire aspect of the investigation is completely different. You know, then I would approach a little bit more like I would a cryptid case, where I'm going to go out there, I'm going to look for prints, I'm going to collect potential samples very, very carefully, not to get any DNA on them, to use very clean collection methodologies, document my process on video and film, or with a witness, and with a witness, I should say, so all my collection methodology is known, documented. And because if you're going to collect physical information of a potential UFO, you better have your T's crossed and your I's dotted. But don't dot your physical eyes. I mean, your eyes, you get it. You just got to be careful of how you're doing stuff. You can't be in a rush just to throw it on YouTube and show the world, I collected this, I grabbed it with my bare hand and threw it in a plastic bag. Great. You just damaged it. Any DNA is worthless. You know, you just ruined the sample. Yeah, don't poke yourself in the eyes. So then comes what people usually don't like. And I talk about this and people get upset that I talk about this so much. The interview process. Yes, you actually have to talk to people when you investigate ghosts, UFOs, or crypto. You just can't say, hey, tell me what happened. I mean, you could, and most people do, but it's not really going to give you as much information as you think you're going to get. You have to set up the environment. You don't want any distractions. You want that client to know the time frame, how long we're going to be here, how long are we going to talk. And as an interviewer, as a researcher, investigator, you have to own and control that interview. Yeah, definitely want to record everything. With permission, of course, audio and video, as well as audio and video. So you have backup copies of everything that's said so that you can go back and relive that in case things change or maybe you forgot a detail or whatever. I use what I call the 5-minute method. It's something I created. If somebody else has it or has been using it, I apologize. I thought I came up with it myself. So basically what I do is I ask somebody to describe their day in their own words, and I'll use this basically as a baseline for how they describe things and how they convey emotion. So how do they react when they're talking about their personal life, when their guard is down? And then I can kind of relate that to when they're talking about their sighting, kind of mesh the two to see where if there's inconsistencies. Most people go quickly when they're describing their day. They don't describe very much in detail. So I have them go back and tell me about something specific that happened to them, such as breakfast. And I tell them to take 5 minutes to describe the entire process. And people are like, 5 minutes? Wow, okay. But you know, I teach them. I kind of coach them through that process. What do they normally eat? Normally, what did you have that morning? If it was cereal, okay, well, how did you go about it? What did you get first? Did you get the cereal box out? Did you get the bowl? Did you get the spoon? Which hand do you use to open the cupboard with? Which hand do they use to grab the spoon? You used the bowl. What color was the bowl? Blue? Well, what color blue? Cobalt? Royal? Navy? You get the picture. So just asking them to be as descriptive as possible, kind of training them on that and having them describe it. It's kind of a fun experience. And it really helps loosen them up as well to get into talking about their experience. So as they begin to describe their experience, I'm going to ask similar questions, having them try to open up. And of course, I'm trying not to interrupt, but make them realize just how much detail I'm looking for. So after that warm-up exercise, I'll tell them to explain their experience from beginning to end. After that, I'll ask them to essentially reconstruct the circumstances. So what led them to that point of witnessing something? People usually say, well, I was out walking the dog. Then I looked up and I saw this bright light in the sky, and I had to wipe a tear away because it was so bright. Okay, so then I'll let them tell the story, but then I'll go back and, okay, set it up. So you took your dog out for a walk, but go back before that. What were you doing before you took the dog out? Were you sleeping? Were you on the couch watching TV? Were you on the computer doing things you weren't supposed to do? What were you doing? And so just to kind of set the context, because there may be things that may have led to them not really being able to perceive their environment. If there are things I'm not sure about or I think that they're not sure of, I'll ask them to focus on that one part of the experience and just really kind of go over it a little bit more. I may even ask them to describe certain things from a different perspective or a different vantage point, which can actually help the memory jar things loose at times. So this part of this process, it's based on, again, my experience in the ghost field for over 20 years and just interviewing people, as well as a method called the cognitive interview, which is what the police and FBI use to interview subjects who have seen things. I mean, a lot of people just want to hit the door and just set up equipment and start looking for ghosts, get out in the woods, start beating on trees, looking for Bigfoot, or just start searching the skies, maybe use a laser pointer to try to contact a UFO. But the interview or the person's story is the most important thing. I mean, are you really there to investigate a UFO? No. You're there to investigate their story. So that's why an interview is so important. Now, can we prove that somebody saw a UFO? No. But we can provide them with potential logical solutions that maybe they actually saw. And we can never take their belief of what they saw away from. We might convince them of a logical solution, but they're going to be the only ones that can change their minds. We can't do that for them, nor do we want to be the one that forced them. We want them to come to that conclusion on their own, which most times they won't. UFO investigations offer us something we can't do in the ghost field or the cryptozoology field, like I started to say before, and that's actually recreate the scene. That's right, in the UFOs, you can recreate the scene. What am I talking about? I mean, there's no known ways to validate or confirm a ghost is present, and a cryptid may make a mark that Mother Nature is more than likely going to erase, usually pretty quickly. With UFOs, we have multiple resources to recreate what a person might have seen and maybe help provide a logical solution. Again, it's not going to prove that they saw a UFO. So if we know where they saw the thing, we can use historical weather to determine maybe there was storms going through the area. Heavy winds might have blown things around. They might have misinterpreted something that way. You can have access to radar data, flight tracker data, historical data to airplanes in certain areas in certain parts of the world. Satellite position data, so if they saw something at night and at a certain time of night, it can tell me maybe they saw an iridium flare. They saw essentially a high altitude piece of metal turning in the sky that reflected sunlight down, and maybe that's what they saw. We can find those data readily available on the internet. We can also look at star charts, other celestial information such as planet positions, comets, and other phenomena that may have occurred at those times. We can look at AMS data, American Meteor Society information of meteor sightings all over the world, and determine what angle people might have seen them from. So we can build an image of the sky. If we know the direction, we know the time somebody saw something, we can really paint a picture of what they might have seen. And again, you can't really do that in any other paranormal field. So that's why I like UFO investigations better. So anyway, moving along. I got a couple more stories I want to cover real quick. Want to talk about near-death experiences. This was a really interesting article, and I've really struggled to find any good ghost news to talk about here on the show. And I guess the way to get to the bottom of the question of what causes near-death experiences is to answer what happens to not just the body, because we know the body just shuts down. You don't just die, by the way. There's no off switch to the body. Different parts of your body die at different times. I know it's not something that people want to think about, especially before you go to bed. But yes, the body starts breaking down and dying at different times. Take quite a while sometimes. But not just the body, but the brain. But also the mind and our perception of the world and our bodies, which is known as consciousness. So Inverse.com attempts to gather information on this topic in an article published over the weekend. The article's subheadline states that, quote, a third of people who've had a brush with death report having one. So in other words, a third of people who have had a brush with death reported a near-death experience. Near-death experiences may have an out-of-body experience as well during it, which essentially means a person feels detached from their body. Of course, many have heard of the long tunnel leading to the light, or maybe a person feels contentment or very calm, even though they're going through the death experience. Many walk away from this experience with a diminished fear of death and embrace life like never before. Others have stated the opposite. They feel the experience was very negative. The person felt non-existent, saw imagery of hell or being judged by somebody. A culture and potential age may also be factors in what a person experiences, as people from different cultures may encounter their deity of choice or potentially family members or someone else specific to them. I found an interesting breakdown of why behind near-death experiences, and I'll read that one. That particular paragraph here, it says, quote, neuroscientists Olaf Blank and Sebastian Diegues have proposed two types of near-death experiences. Type 1, which is associated with the brain's left hemisphere, features an altered sense of time and impressions of flying. Type 2, involving the right hemisphere, is characterized by seeing or communicating with spirits and hearing voices, sounds, and music. While it's unclear why there are different types of near-death experiences, the different interactions between the brain regions produce these distinct experiences, unquote. The article then gets into some of the more technical aspects, including temporal lobes that must play a part, since this part of the brain is deals with sensory information and memory. Religious people tend to think near-death experiences are proof of life after death. There's also a suggestion of endorphins. And anesthetics are also thought to trigger experiences as well. Another possibility was brought forth by a gentleman named Rick Strassman, who is a professor of psychiatry. He observed, and I'll just read this, quote, in a study from 1990 to 1995 that people had near-death and mystical experiences following injection of DMT. According to Strassman, the body has natural DMT released at birth and death. However, there is no conclusive evidence to support this view, unquote. Of course, DMT, if you don't know, also known as dimethyltryptamine. Don't ask me why I know that word off the top of my head, dimethyltryptamine. It's a psychedelic drug. Again, I wouldn't have any knowledge of that whatsoever. It's actually found in some plants, but chemical-based hypotheses I should say, don't really hold up under the sheer amount of diversity of the people and the types of experiences related with near-death experiences. I don't think you could just sum it all up by one chemical or the other. Then, of course, you have the boring explanations such as cerebral anoxia, which is essentially lack of oxygen to the brain, which I think a lot of people suffer from. And to finish the article, I'll quote the last two lines, which read, quote, one researcher found air pilots who experienced unconsciousness during rapid acceleration, and they described near-death experience-like features, such as tunnel vision. Lack of oxygen may also trigger temporal lobe seizures, which cause hallucinations. These may be similar to a near-death experience, unquote. So that's really cool to see some near-death experience articles written out there. And I'll throw that in the chat room. And don't worry, it's getting late. I know it's my bedtime as well. Don't worry. I've got one quick story. It's about dragons. You don't want to miss dragons. Everybody loves dragons. I don't care who you are. Everybody likes dragons. So one last story for you tonight. Because we certainly don't want to end the show talking about death. It's not a good way to end a show. So we're going to talk about dragons. Yay, dragons. Let's see. So meanwhile, in the United Kingdom, North Wales police are warning drivers on the lookout for a creature that might make driving conditions dangerous. The creature? Yes. A 25-foot-long dragon. A real live dragon is on the loose in North Wales. And it's been seen along the A5 with its 12-foot wingspan. If you don't believe me, which I know you don't, I actually have a picture. Yes, a picture of a dragon. Somebody was able to get close enough to this thing and take a picture. You're not going to believe this. And if you're in the chat room, get ready for this. This is real. This is a real dragon. It's a real picture. Really happened. There it is. Yep. So, despite the build-up to this, you might have guessed it. No, it's not a real living, fire-breathing dragon, but it's in fact a carving. A 30-inch diameter branch, I guess that's like a log, had fallen, and Simon O'Rourke, an illustrator and chainsaw carver, created the dragon in a spot where the mighty oak branch fell on a hill along the road. O'Rourke worked for 5.5 days on the project, which has become a local phenomena and worry for police, as well as the A5 is a busy and dangerous road. And it's a beautiful carving. I wasn't going to talk about it because it's not paranormal. But I thought, my goodness, it's really just, and you have to read about this guy and how he did this. And it's just really incredible just to look at this and look at the other art stuff that he has. And put that link in the chat room. There he is with his still. And yeah, he added some parts to it. It's not just completely cut out from the log, but the pieces of that log were placed on there as well. It's beautiful, though, that he put that all together. So I'm going to put the links of that in the chat room real quick. But for the rest of you guys, I appreciate you hanging out in the chat room. I appreciate you listening live if you did. And I also appreciate it if you didn't listen live, but you are listening later on as a podcast. I appreciate everybody who listens to the show, and it's great to see. I'm not in love with numbers and things like that. I can care less how many hundreds or thousands of people listen to the show. I do it because I love doing it, and I do it because I know people like listening to the reality behind these stories. But when I do see numbers and I do see that people are listening, it makes me want to get up and do it again the next week. So I appreciate everybody out there that spends your time listening to the show. Feedback, good, bad, or indifferent about the show and what I talk about. I do appreciate it, and especially you guys in the chat room hanging out with me for an hour. I really, really appreciate that. So that being said, I will see you next week But for now, keep your eyes in the skies, your ears in the woods, the hair standing on the back of your neck, and always keep your mind slightly ajar. And above all else, don't stop believing. For the Paranormal News Insider, this is Dr. Brian D. Parsons reporting.